Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamatasa tavara ye sorvanta bamunjantu sadhang. So this has become an annual event, instigated by Chandi Pereira, who's, but he's not here today, because he's recently married, and I think he's on a honeymoon. So this is also a reflection. Because to have gratitude, it's something that you need to contemplate your life in a way that's different in the way we tend to dwell on what's gone wrong or what should have been, or oftentimes what our parents should have done. In the Western world, we tend to see our parents through critical eyes more than through gratitude. Where in Sri Lanka, I think it's more the other way. Or in Thailand, the attitude of gratitude to parents is very considered very important. So this is a cultural difference. And it's interesting that a place like Amravati, where the East and West, the twain meets, where the Western Buddhists, Eastern Buddhists come together, and we learn from each other in a way that both are, you know, what it's like to the good qualities of Asian tradition or culture that's developed out of a Buddhist philosophy or religious perception, and say Western European culture or civilization that has a very different background based on Judaism, Christianity, and modern science. And yet it's interesting to notice in the past 50 years how much interest there is in the Western world in Buddhism. In the Buddhist terms, having a human birth is considered a great fortune. It's considered a birth that is hard to get, in terms if you believe in rebirth or attuned to that way of thinking, that we don't have just one life, and at the end of it, it's completely nothing after that. That there's this sense of, in its more coarse aspects of reincarnation, and its more subtle aspects, we call it rebirth. And so this is a way of contemplating that this life is, we can see it in terms of a one-off situation, without any, you know, it doesn't matter what we do, because in the end it's just oblivion anyway. There's one way of looking at it. We can be caught up in the idea that if we fail in this one, then we don't get another chance. Either you're condemned to heaven, or you're condemned to hell, or you go to heaven. Or you might sustain yourself in some kind of neutral state that's pretty dreary, limbo or whatever. But the fact is, we don't really know. We don't. These are we're talking about something that happens when our body is dead. So we don't know, we can't really imagine that, what that would really be. We can imagine it, but we don't really know what it is. Because our experience now is one of consciousness, feeling, sensation, incarcerated in a form, conscious form, for a lifetime. And from how we perceive ourselves in the universe that we're living in, we can just be culturally conditioned to perceive it according to what we're told and operate from those kind of attitudes, or in more spiritual awakening states, we're opening and contemplating what is consciousness, what is sensitivity, what is life, in a way that we're reflecting on it, observing and noticing, paying attention, rather than just operating from preconceptions or attitudes or assumptions that are never questioned. I remember in Thailand, going there, we were encouraged in the monasteries to contemplate the goodness of our lives. Now, this was something that was quite strange to me, because I'd never really thought of it in that way. I mean, I was very much aware of what was wrong with myself, or I have become very critical of my parents, of the society that I was born into and grew up in the class or the group or the peer group that I was living with. One could just, one was more aware of what was wrong, their deficiencies, their weaknesses and faults, than aware of their goodness, the good qualities that they have. And that also applied to myself, thinking in terms of seeing myself through what's wrong, what isn't very good, or the weaknesses. And in the Thai forest tradition, the Lungpo Cha was very keen on us contemplating the goodness of our human birth. Well, that never occurred to me, that human birth was particularly good fortune. I mean, I was getting quite cynical when I ordained. By the time I became a monk, I was much more kind of looking at it as a kind of cosmic bad joke, because it didn't seem to have any point to it. It didn't have any purpose. The kind of attitudes that seemed to be common around me in those days, where people were just weren't looking very deeply and mainly just seeking pleasure and experience and excitement, and then there were the endless kind of anxieties and fears and emotional problems, neurotic hang-ups that everyone seemed to be experiencing in societies like this one, or in the United States, where I'm originally from, where people tended to, even though they had everything, were not particularly, it didn't particularly give them any great confidence and sense of self-respect or inner peace. They seem to get more kind of neurotic and anxious than they ever were. So what is the purpose of our life? You know, why are we born? What does being human mean? Does it have any, is it just a one-off situation? You're born, grow up, get old and die, and that's it? Well, one thing you can know is you don't know. I mean, other people might have views about it, and they might be very interesting views or very good views, or even they might even be right. But the fact is, we don't really know in terms of direct experience, because we haven't experienced physical death yet. Except it's interesting to talk to people who have had these kind of death experiences, but they don't fully die, they come back. And almost all of them see it in a very positive light. Their experience of death is, I've talked to most of them, their fear of death is gone after that. They no longer have any fear about it. And the death experience was actually a pleasant one rather than an unpleasant one. But I haven't had any of those, so I don't know. Just what they say, I listen to. But knowing I don't know, knowing that I will know when the body dies, but awakening to life as an experience now, then how can we live our lives so that we do find happiness in it, so we do have inner peace, so we can appreciate the good things of our own, of our families, of our humanity, of our society, without being continually obsessed and overwhelmed by the things that we don't like about it. Well, just applying to oneself, for example, is, you know, one can see in my own life, you know, things that I don't particularly like about myself. That I can be quite critical of, and I don't particularly, I used to wish that I didn't have those kind of tendencies or faults. But then the mind can get hung up on that alone, isn't it? Just seeing that is something, you know, bewailing or resenting the fact that I didn't get, you know, the best of the best, perfection. that I could just be angry and resentful the rest of my life over that. Or contemplating life. In this Buddhist meditative style, in that we're actually reflecting on life is like this. When we think of the law of karma and of rebirth, then we think, this is what I must learn from. This, the way I am, the way my physical appearance, my emotional habits, my abilities, mental abilities, all this is something that, say, I can, instead of comparing it to thinking that if I had the best, all the best equipment, then my life would have been a much happier one. Or looking at it in terms of this is what I learned from the way I am, from this thing that I have now, in it, both its positive and negative aspects. So that makes life interesting, and then we also begin to have much more acceptance of everybody else, because we're not thinking in terms of an ideal man or woman all the time about, you know, and then always feeling there's something wrong with everybody because nobody quite fits into that ideal of perfection. I don't know anybody. In the newspaper now, they're talking all about Princess Diana's problems. And you think, well, she's got as good as anybody on the planet. And you think, well, I'm certainly glad I didn't have to deal with her. but when you're at physical beauty or social status and privilege and on like that, one can feel, if you don't have the best, then one can be quite resentful. But in terms of karma, looking at the way I am, even you know, even my defects, my faults, have been important in my life because it's something you learn from. If your attitude towards it changes from resentment and self-aversion toward taking charge of life, really seeing, well, this is what I've got, this is what I learned from. This is what we say in the Buddhist world, this is my karma. But it's not a kind of fatalistic resignation, you know, to, well, this is my karma in a negative way. It's an embracing of it. This is what I learned from. This is what I have to learn in this lifetime from being this way, from being a man, from being this kind of person, this character, this appearance in this at this time, with my family, my parents, my social background. A lot of people do have tremendous problems of feeling inferior because maybe their social background isn't very good, or all these different racial perceptions and or class perceptions or ideas of men and women and gender perceptions around which is better or which is the most fortunate, or seen in terms of the best, trying to choose out what is the best. That's ridiculous, isn't it? Because that's not the way it is. It's all we learn from the way it is. If we're born in a low status, in a poverty-stricken country, with insensitive parents, we can still learn from that. That's not an obstruction to enlightenment. Or being Princess Diana, brought up in privilege and wealth and all the rest, you know, we could still learn from that if we awakened, if we opened ourselves to life and decided to contemplate it, reflect upon it. Well, I noticed that in the old days, before I really understood this, then I would get the fashion of my generation was to be very critical, especially of your mother. You know, back in the 50s, it was the mother that was blamed for everything. You know, if anything was wrong in your life, it was due to your mother. And it's changed now, it's the fathers that are getting it. Back in the 1950s, we all remember taking Psychology 100 at the university, and then suddenly, you know, realizing, probably my fears and my social inadequacies and that were all due to my mother. So this was, I remember. It was, you know, sitting together with other students and discussing our mothers, what was wrong with our mothers. And because we were all at that age, you know, 17, 18 years old, we're trying to get away from them. And they're trying to hang on to us, we're trying to pull out. And well, that seemed, you know, even at that age, because when you're 18, you think you know everything anyway. And you certainly know much more than your mother or father do. That's the way it seems. And you remember determining, I was never going to do the same things, commit the same errors that my mother and father committed. You know, and I was going to learn from life, and I was going to make changes. I wasn't going to be like them. Though I have been, my mother and father were not Buddhist monks, so I have. I'm out of my word. This was about the last thing I think they ever expected me to. I don't think they ever thought that I would ever be a Buddhist monk. That was not a possible perception in their catalog of perceptions. But then in monastic life and living in a Buddhist country like Thailand, the attitude was different. And living in the Thai forest tradition, the Thai forest tradition is a meditative monastic tradition, and has particularly strong roots in the northeastern part of Thailand, called the Isan. And the Isan is the poorest part of Thailand. It's the place nobody really wants to go. Or like you talk to civil servants in Bangkok, the idea of being posted to Ubon or northeast Thailand is like, must be for like a Russian going to Siberia. You know, it's the least salubrious part of that country. And in those days, this was back in the 60s, it was very poor area, third world, rice-growing, undeveloped part of Thailand. But the Isan is very famous for producing some of the greatest monks that in Thai history. So the attitude is that because life is so hard and difficult there, that it somehow that hardship seems to build a lot of character. And living in northeast Thailand for 10 years, I developed enormous respect for the Isan people, because living in northeast Thailand and depending on those people, and knowing them and their villages, their village life and so forth, I was getting beyond just a kind of tourist perception of them or an anthropologist view. I was really living as part of a community, like being in the family of that group, being integrated within that particular society itself. So I found it, tremendous respect for these people, these village people that I would live with every day for 10 years. And then Lung Pon Chah was, of course, one of them, but he was exceptional, really. In the terms that he was a very wise human being, and even though he wasn't particularly well educated, he didn't go through the Buddhist universities or anything. He was educated, well enough. He was a very intelligent person, but his gift wasn't on that level. It was more on his insight, his wisdom, and his understanding of the human condition, what it is to be a human being, what it is to be a man or a monk, or living or having consciousness, living within a human form with consciousness, being in this incredibly sensitive state all the time, having to deal with the endless problems, difficulties that life presents to us, no matter where we are. But Lung Pon Chah, being Buddhist from a Buddhist family, Buddhist cultural background, he had a very fortunate beginning, actually, because he did have something basically there in his cultural references, in his perceptions, that were based on wisdom. And then he developed his life. His faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha and living his life, his adult life as a Buddhist monk. And so because one couldn't help but admire and respect such a human being, then everything he said had great significance. You wouldn't dismiss anything he said. Because you where you might dismiss it if your father said it, but not if Ajahn Chah. Not if Ajahn Chah said it. So this is developing a sense of respect and trust in a human being of a different culture. He was only, I think, 15 years older than I was, but he seemed, you know, he was perfectly fulfilled the father image in my life, the kind of ideal father, the wise, compassionate father. But this kind of role wasn't particularly one I consciously sought after, but it did seem to, you know, I did definitely feel when I met Lungpa Cha a sense of wanting to stay and learn from him. And so he was, his questioning into, you know, the reflection on being human. At the time when the attitude in Thailand, of course, being Buddhist country, is that it's very fortunate to have human birth, and I used to kind of snicker at this. You know, I think that's just cultural Thai culture. You know, thinking it was, you know, just the way that you have to think if you're brought up in that system. But then, when I started meditating, practicing meditation, I began to realize the great gift we have as human beings. And before, I never realized what they meant, you know, in the Buddhist terminology, what humanity really means. They use the word manusia. They say it's a, and it has the word man in it, actually. It says manusia, human. Well, probably all comes from the same source. So the manusia is considered a fortunate birth. And they even have such images of it's such a rare thing to be a human being that it's like a turtle out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and every once in a while it might just by chance surface, and there's a kind of round, kind of donut-like circle floating on top of the ocean, and that turtle happens to, right at that moment, its head enters the center of that donut. That's that was the metaphor, that was the image of how rare it is to be born as human. So I thought, well, the human population is certainly increasing. And turtles are getting better on the mark than that. Or is, you know, if one just looks at human birth in terms of a physical one, but then it goes much deeper than that, just assuming that we're all human, because we all have human, what we call human bodies. But the thing that really struck me as profound about our humanity wasn't the physical side of it, because, you know, orangutans and chimpanzees aren't that much different. And we have, you know, we're quite animal bodies, actually. But the thing that which really expresses our humanity is our reflective ability. We have a reflective mind, in other words. Or you can put it in terms, we have a Buddha mind, because the word Buddha means the awakenedness. So this awakenedness isn't like just being awake in the kind of ordinary terms we think of, that we are awake. It's really paying attention, being with the moment. This sense of awakenedness isn't just having your eyes open and sitting daydreaming or worrying about the future. To a Buddhist, that wouldn't be awake. Awakenedness is where there is mindfulness, there's attention, and you're fully with this present moment. So that then it realized how rare that is, to be fully awake. In even, you know, when I reflected on my own life, how much of my life was spent in a kind of fantasy world, or in just in delusions of worry and anxiety or resentment, or, you know, used to wake up in the morning just feeling this kind of dread take me over, just waking up and thinking, oh, another day, wonder what horrible things are going to happen today, that kind of thing. Before I became a monk, I was getting, you know, really quite depressed about life, thinking, you know, that 30 years old, I felt like kind of burnt out. Like my life didn't have any, you know, I kind of lived it and somehow failed it. And the days, you know, waking up in the morning was not particularly, you know, getting up and being another day to live and practice meditation and awaken to experience. It was, oh, another day. What am I going to do today? What should I? And then the sense of that there's something I've got to do. That there's always this kind of obsession in the background. There's more. You've got to do something you haven't done that you should be doing. There's something you should be, you know, you've got to learn. You've got to get hold of that you don't have yet. And you've got to change. You've got to get rid of your bad habits. You've got to do something about it. Get rid of them, and you've got to become something. So this seemed to increase as I grew older. This sense of inadequacy and this obsession about having to, that there's something I've got to do. In monastic life, then this helped to reflect these kind of tendencies. These were emotional habits. Have you been through graduate school, for example? The pressures that I experienced in graduate school were so strong, you know, that you got this, you know, you couldn't have a cup of coffee without thinking, should I be taking time out to have coffee? I've got an exam coming. I've got to study. So there was always, it became obsessive, so that I couldn't really enjoy anything unless I could kind of get drunk enough to forget about it. So the use of alcohol in university life is, you know, if you don't meditate, then you've probably got to take to drink just to get through it. But then in meditation, suddenly I began to, because we monks were not allowed to drink. But we can reflect on these fears or these obsessions. Then living in a monastic community that wasn't particularly the cultural ambience that I was living in. It was a much more kind of life was the Northeast Thai, the life was you know, doesn't really matter, you know, just have, you know, enjoy things, you know, don't make a problem. And they have this saying, my bin rai, you know, doesn't really matter, kind of do it tomorrow or whatever. And so that this kind of drivenness wasn't particularly part of the community spirit. But it helped to reflect it in myself, because even though I was living with Thai forest monks, I still had this incredible kind of obsessive drive in me. You know, I always had to be doing something, had to be either fasting, had to be doing things to, like, to not sleep, not laying down, or sleeping, sitting up, or doing especially long alms rounds. Or I felt, unless I was really putting forth 100% effort, that it wasn't good enough. So this was, and Lungpon Char was wise enough to kind of let me go on this way for a while, but he began to point out, you know, that this wasn't really what was expected. And that, you know, that maybe I could relax and eat my food without feeling without making a problem about it, or that I didn't have to always go to extremities in the practice. I think I thought in those days that was, you know, going to extremities was what was expected. You know, forest monk, really tough, you know, don't give in to weakness, conquer your defilements. All this was, you know, carrying a flag, and, you know, quite for a young man, quite the kind of warrior style to it, you know, conquering the devil, getting rid of the enemy. But gratitude to parents then became, you know, I noticed Lungpa Chah's mother was a nun when I was there the first few years, first 3 or 4 years. His mother was, when her husband died and so forth, then she became a Merchi or a Buddhist nun. And so every day, Lungpa Chah, when we'd pass the food, when we'd have our meal, we had this one meal a day, and when we come back from the alms round, we'd all go to different villages, different collecting food, and then we'd come back, and we'd all put the food in a central place, and then we'd distribute it. When the time came, we'd sit in lines with our bowls, and then various monks were assigned to distribute this food. Well, I noticed Lungpa Chah was always the first one. Of course, he was the teacher and the most senior. So, but he always kept aside food for his mother, who is a nun. They had these little kind of tiffin carriers, these layered, they're called pintos in Thai. And so he'd always be putting this, you know, looking out for nice things he knew his mother liked, and then looking after his mom, you know. And then she died when I was there, and we had the most incredible funeral for her I've ever seen. We spent months preparing for it, and Ajahn Chah had incredible imagination. He would have been a great kind of theatrical person. But what we proceeded to do during the month was to where the temple is now, the Uposatha Hall that exists now in Wat Pa Pong in Thailand, that wasn't there then. That was just a kind of flat land with a few trees on it. So there we built a grotto, cave grottos in a kind of circle, out of paper mache and bamboo, and we spent afternoons weaving a bamboo strips into basket-like forms, and then we built this thing up into kind of huge mountainous structures with little tunnels through them into this center kind of circle, where they would burn the corpse of Lungpa Chah's mother when the day came. So, and then they covered all these bamboo kind of basket-like things we'd made, and with newspaper and so forth, and then spray painted it, make it look like rocks, like mountains, and it was immense, you know, it was quite high, in a quite a large area. So then, this was all Lungpa Chah's idea. to a setting, stage setting, for the funeral of his mother. And I don't think I've ever seen anything like it since, either. So then, the day came, and of course, a monk of Ajahn Chah's stature was, you know, especially in Northeast Thailand, was so high that, of course, there were thousands and thousands of people came to the funeral of his mother. And of course, he reflected on the goodness of his parents. Well, he is from a farming family in the nearby village near the Wat Pa Pong temple, and it was. And so he grew up as a, you know, farm. They were kind of, you know, put. They weren't wealthy, but they weren't poor. They had land, and they had, you know, for that part of Thailand, they were probably considered well enough off, you know, quite pillars of the community in the village, and highly regarded family. I started contemplating my own, you know, I began to appreciate my own humanity as I developed in meditation. So I began to recognize, you know, that instead of this cynical attitude of what a bad joke it is to be born as a human being, I began to appreciate the fact that I have, because the thing that I really value is this reflectiveness. This is what gives the whole meaning to our lives. You know, if you don't know this, then life is just more or less you get through it somehow, but it doesn't have much meaning to it. And it's, you know, you try to live it as happily as you can. But when you begin to recognize the gift that we have in our humanity, then we begin to, we don't even demand that our life be a successful or happy one. Because we're quite willing to learn from life as we have to live it and experience it. That means physically, with health and whatever health problems or physical weaknesses or disabilities that we might have, as well as emotional habits and mental problems on that level. So this also, I began to appreciate my own parents, because I realized how fortunate I was, because actually when I look back, I came from very good parents. And they provided a very stable home life for my sister and I, and they, you know, when, especially as you get older, you realize how difficult life is, and how difficult life must have been for your mother and father, who didn't have all the advantages that my sister and I had, you know, because we were born in the 30s, and my parents grew up at the time, you know, at the turn of the century, so they were kind of middle class people, but they didn't have the options. They were more or less expected and pushed and forced into doing things. And then in the Depression of the 30s, my father, who was training to be a commercial artist, had to give up all his ambitions to just try to get enough food just for survival. You know, because they lost their money in the Depression. So these are the things that parents didn't really say much about, but you know, they'd mention it now and then. And then I recognize how that they had to, you know, by the time my sister and I came along, that was their main interest, was in trying to provide for us. And oftentimes parents want to give their children all the things they didn't have also. So they managed to encourage us towards, you know, kind of scholastic, academic achievements and all the rest, encouraging us towards much more kind of to do the things for the fulfillment that we could experience that both my mother and father didn't have much of an opportunity to or expectation for. So when I think of that, then I begin to this arises, this gratitude arises. So this is like deliberately reflecting on it, and that I choose to think like this. Well, I could choose to think of the things I don't like about them. I have a choice, but when I start doing that, then somehow, you know, now I think I don't see any point in it, because it doesn't bring a wholesome state. It brings up that kind of resentment and a kind of unpleasantness in my mind that doesn't help me in my spiritual development. But if I think in terms of gratitude, or what we call katanyu gataveti, this katanyu gataveti is then this is a joyful kind of feeling that I have. I think of the goodness of my parents, or my teacher Lungpo Cha. I think of him, or of all the good friends, or my sister, who's always been a good friend, or the goodness of the society I was born into. You know, how much freedom, opportunity, I've experienced being American, being born in the kind of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant privileged group of the Americans. So, or in and being born in on the West Coast, nice place like Seattle, you know, a pleasant enough place to live and grow up and have so much space and so many beautiful mountains and natural scenery there is extraordinary. Gratitude also, I didn't begin to feel gratitude even for the misfortunes of my life. So like when I was in the military, I had, you know, had this a really bad experience at the last year that I was in the Navy. And I was blamed for something I didn't do, and I was very angry about it. And nobody apologized. They just kind of dropped it, and I just left in this state of just incredible resentment and anger and hatred to the military. And so when I left the military, you know, I carried this for years with me, this resentment. And then in meditation, and when I, in Thailand, I began to notice, because you're reflecting on what's actually happening in your mind. I noticed, here I am, 20 years later, living in northeast Thailand in a Buddhist monastery with a great teacher, and then a memory of this thing in the Navy comes up in my mind, and I feel just as angry as I did then. So, what is this about? You know, that, you know, then my rational mind says, oh, just forget it, you know, it's long ago, things are like that. Because, you know, your kind of intellect says, just, you know, forget it, it's nothing, it happened, just drop it, you know, and don't think about it. But still, you know, even though that might be sound like common sense, it isn't that easy, is it? And you can't just drop it. Because it's an emotion. So this particular memory of this unfortunate incident would bring up anger and resentment. So this is what we're reflecting on. We're beginning to see how they connect, how even this the memory can just, you know, remembering some unfortunate thing in the past trigger off such a strong feeling. And then by noticing that, by paying attention to that, observing it, then I began to see how to let go of it. Not just say, don't pay attention, just drop it, you know. Just grow up, get over it, doesn't matter. Because that's a kind of suppressing of it, isn't it? It's a denial or a rejection of it. But this way is an exploration of it, how it happens. So, since we have retentive memories, then we remember. We especially remember the unfortunate things of our life. You don't remember the ordinariness of your life. You know, just the kind of ordinary things that you have in most of your life, but your memory usually is around the peak moments, the nadirs of your experience, where you life at its worst or life at its best. But then this was just able to observe this knowing in the present, this awareness, can be aware of this memory. So I can still remember it now. I can bring it up right into my mind right now, just remember it. But you notice, I'm not angry. I remembered it in that moment, but understanding how it works, then the emotional habit kind of falls away. you're not feeding it, you're not fueling that particular emotion anymore. So it loses its power and its impact on your consciousness. So then I found after a while, because I examined that one so much, as a kind of way of looking at how my mind worked, I learned so much from it, and I was actually grateful for having had that experience in the military. Because it gave me something, I felt so wounded and hurt and so oppressed and so misunderstood and so angry, and all these kind of feelings would arise, even wanting to take revenge. Remember this Robert Mitchum movie back in the 50s, where he pursues, he's a kind of psychopath, and he pursues this woman, calling her on the phone and threatening her all the time. And I kept thinking, maybe I should do that to this. wanting to seek revenge. Fortunately, I'm not vindictive, so I didn't pursue it. But the thought did arise, and it did give me a kind of satisfaction in thinking of torturing the person. These kind of demonic emotions. I certainly can see how they can arise, and the kind of pleasure they can give you of making someone suffer for having made me suffer. But then in terms of reflecting, I learned so much from that I would, I feel gratitude. It's something that the problems of my life, the difficulties, all this, and then instead of seeing them as in terms of it shouldn't be like this, then these are opportunities to explore and examine. Because when something really hurts, is really painful or really unfair, and where we can become so righteously indignant and so angry, that also is a chance to learn how to understand how this mental process takes place. Because our real interest now is in developing this Buddha mind, this reflective awareness, rather than in demanding life be something according to an ideal that it should be. Isn't it? Here in England we think everything, like people should be fair. Everything, that we've got to be fair, and everything should be, done with that in mind. And we have these very fine kind of democratic ideals and so forth. But then, in terms of experience, life isn't always going to be that way. Sometimes it is, much of the time it's not. And to bemoan and bewail the fact that it's not is a kind of, it just makes us miserable. Makes me miserable to just dwell on how unfair life is. Or learning from unfairness. Learning from the meanness of life, or the pettiness, or the failures, or the injustices, as well as from the good things of this life. Because, as I said before, this sense of really taking life on as experience, beginning to see that this is what I learned from this. From the way I am. And this I found in Buddhist countries, they do have a way of dealing with tragedy, with misfortune, in a way that is much better than what we have in the West. Because for one thing, in the Buddhist country, they recognize that it's natural, it's part of nature. Old age, sickness, death, not getting what you want, failure and misfortune can be quite seen in terms of just the way life is, or they can say it's their karma. They can say it's my karma. It's a way of accepting something. It can be It can't, the only criticism I have for that is that, that one can see it in a kind of fatalistic way. It's a kind of just, well, that's in a kind of resigning yourself to a kind of miserable state in a very passive or negative way. It can be on that level. Or it can be a very wise reflection that the things that happen to me are the result of my karma, because this allows me to learn from it. If I just see myself as a helpless victim in a heartless universal system and just say it's my fate and I'm just meant to suffer and can't do anything about it, then that isn't a reflection, isn't it? That's not awakening to it. It's you're merely identifying with misery and not learning from it. And kind of resigning yourself and getting depressed by the misfortunes of life. But when I say it's my karma, that's not what I'm doing. It's not a justification or a passive resignation, but a reflection on if it's whatever it is, you know, good or bad, it's what I learn from. So then it gives importance even to the misfortunes, the failures, the problems, the difficulties, the vicissitudes of a human lifetime. Then I reflect that I wouldn't be here if it weren't for my parents. and sometimes I remember used to feeling quite angry with them, thinking, you know, here they had, you know, here I was born in the middle of a depression. Second World War, I grew up during the Second World War. My parents wanted to have children. They had a few moments of pleasure, and then I have to suffer a lifetime for it. So that's one way of looking at it. You know, if they really loved me, they wouldn't have had me. You know? But that doesn't bring any joy to the heart, or is it, you know, it's an impossibility, isn't it? Because this is the way life is. We're here. In terms of my own parents, I've been, you know, they were good. They were very devout Christians, and of a good kind. They weren't kind of narrow and nasty about it. It was a kind of a beautiful kind of Christianity that they were aligned with. So my experience with Christianity was very positive, really. As a child, so, and then it also the quality of their lives. They were very honorable, honest people, and you know, did their very best to allow me and my sister to develop, you know, as and following what they knew at the time. They weren't arahants, though, my mother and father. So they did have, you know, they did have their moments. But this is, you know, then we look at our own life, and we have forgiveness, don't we? Even living in a community, like a monastic community, where you're very much aware of each other, not just at your best, but at your worst. And living together in the monastic community, we ask forgiveness from each other. So that even just with things that we might do, things unkind or heedless acts that we might do intentionally or unintentionally, Because sometimes we don't even know that we're upsetting somebody, but we are. So even ask forgiveness for that. So this is a way, because life is like this, and in living in human beings, we're in some way always, there's this endless possibility of irritating each other or upsetting each other, because there's so many different factors involved in every moment. You know, we have this, you know, you can't just, you know, you've got to take into account that people are have different attitudes. Here at Amaravati, it's a multicultural sangha. You know, we've got Sri Lankan, Thai, European, American monks and nuns living together. So there's bound to be, you know, irritations or misunderstandings just on the level of on a cultural level, because we would do things, our reactions to things can be quite different. Our assumptions can be quite different. And our cultural habits can be quite different. But this isn't what we're interested in terms of forcing a conformity, but in reflecting on the way it is, on our own irritation. And instead of blaming external sources, now we're stopping that, no longer using that as an excuse of blaming somebody else, but looking at where it all really begins, where the suffering really begins in terms of my suffering. And I can say, you're causing me to suffer, or am I making myself suffer because of you? And so this is a reflection, isn't it? And you know, the average person, say, when you act like that, then I really suffer. You know, your insensitivity and your selfishness is making me suffer all the time. I can't live here anymore because of you, is one way of looking at it. Or I can change the scene that I'm creating a lot of suffering around what you do and what you say. Well, then I can see, I can't, how much right or do I have or ability to control everybody to do things the way they should do according to my standards? And, you know, can I do that? I can't see how I can possibly do that. And if I could, I don't think I would, because it's not, that wouldn't be good for me. It wouldn't be good for you. Because the lesson isn't in trying to make everybody into some kind of neutral thing that doesn't upset, threaten me, or irritate me in any way, but in using the irritations, frustrations of our lives for learning, seen in terms of Dhamma. So then we begin to open to life, because we're no longer afraid of it. We can look at it. We can look at even the fear of it, and the injustices of it, or the nastiness of it, in a way that we begin to understand how things arise and cease as we see it in our own, reflected in our own mind. We also become aware, increasingly aware of the deathless reality that's with us. The stillness, the peace, the natural peace, the purity that we have all the time that we forget through our endless struggling with our feelings and thoughts and emotions. So I offer this as a reflection today to encourage this using this sense of gratitude to parents as a way of reflecting and bringing, you know, a sense of joy into your life, and also recognizing that life is hard work, you know. It's not an easy thing. And you know, most people I know doing the best they can, they don't always do it right. But, and I don't know anybody that is so, you know, wants to, you know, intentionally harm their children, or, and there are a few, but those are rare. And usually it's, the harm is done through maybe trying too hard, or through just not understanding, or through just being overwhelmed with one's own emotional problems. So as we understand this, then we have much more compassion and forgiveness for the people around us, and also for ourselves. And then this is the way that we find to for liberation and freedom from suffering and fear. So I offer this as a reflection.